I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. As children return to school and young people in the DACA program face an uncertain future, today a conversation about kids. A new report from the Annie E. Casey Foundation looks at the health, education, and economic well-being of children across America. By their metrics, Maryland ranks 16th overall. And how does growing up in the U.S. compare with growing up in other countries? Casey Foundation President and CEO Patrick McCarthy, Dr. Kamika Royal, co-director of the Loyola University of Maryland Center for Innovation in Urban Education, and Becky Wagner, the executive director of Advocates for Children and Youth, join me to discuss the best and worst places to be a kid. The 2017 Kids Count Data Book, Midday, starts right after the news. And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome. It's Midday. Very glad you're with us. I'm Tom Hall. You know, most children in Maryland had their first day of school yesterday. Today on our program, a look at the status of children in our state and across the country. On some level, we all know instinctively that where we grow up matters a lot. The estimated 800,000 undocumented young people who were covered by the executive order known as DACA are certainly well aware of that, given that their fate is now very much up in the air following President Trump's decision to rescind that order. So for the DACA kids and all kids, where are the best places to grow up and what makes them the best? A new report from the Annie E. Casey Foundation ranks all 50 states, the District of Columbia, and the territories by measures of health, education, economic well-being, and more. Where does Maryland stand in the rankings? The Kids Count Data Book makes an attempt to answer that and other questions. The good news? 95% of American children now have health care coverage. That's the highest it's ever been. And yet, more than 16 million American children live in poverty, and racial disparities in education, housing, access to health care, and incarceration persist. 2.5 years after violence coursed through our city following the death of Freddie Gray, what has changed fundamentally for children in Sandtown, Winchester, or kids over in East Baltimore? Today, a look at national and local data and a conversation about how it might inform public policy. With me here in Studio A, Patrick McCarthy. He's the president and CEO of the Baltimore-based Annie E. Casey Foundation. It's a private philanthropy that works on a host of issues affecting children. Patrick, good to see you, sir.
Good to see you, Tom.
Dr. Kamika Royal is an assistant professor of urban education at Loyola University, Maryland, and a co-director of Loyola's Center for Innovation in Urban Education. Great to meet you, Dr. Royal.
Thank you for having me here.
And Becky Wagner is here as well. She's the executive director of the Baltimore-based Advocates for Children and Youth. They were a Maryland partner for the Casey Foundation's Kids Count Project. Becky Wagner, nice to meet you
Thank
as well.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You are welcome to join our conversation about kids, what we should be doing in terms of public policy, what we could be doing in our schools, in our cities, in our states, and across the country. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle if you'd like to join us there, and that would be swell, by the way, at midday. Tom Hall. So Patrick McCarthy, this data in this report comes from 2015, as I understand it, which is the latest year we have available data. Why is a philanthropic foundation compiling this data? Is this data that not available through government sources, through other places? I mean, did the Casey Foundation take this on because this was data that just wasn't available?
The data are available, but they're spread all around. And our idea more than 25 years ago was to come out with a report card on how the nation is doing by its children. And so we've identified four areas that make a big difference in kids' lives, how they're doing economically, their health, their education, and then family and community indicators. And we were able to compile data from federal sources for the most part, but we used that data to rank order all 50 states and the District of Columbia in how kids are doing against all of those variables.
And so the audience for this report then is policymakers? Who is it?
This report comes out every year, and it's used by policymakers. We hear all the time from governor's staff and legislative staff that they rely on it. But it's also used by advocates, folks like Becky and Advocates for Youth. There's a similar kind of organization in each of the 50 states that we support. It's used by the general public. It's used by journalists. So it's just a way of lifting up how kids are doing. You know, we spend an awful amount of time and money looking at how our economy is doing. The list of statistics that we track obsessively about how the economy is doing generally, and it's an important list, is quite long. We thought it was important to have a similar kind of list that's kind of the leading child indicators for how the future of the country is going to look, because the kids obviously are going to determine how our country does 15 years from now, 20 years from now, 50 years from now.
Mm-hmm. Of course, any statistical thing is, you know, you got to be careful about it because statistics mm-hmm. tell you only so much. I mean, the work that Becky does, I know, concentrates a lot on individual stories of individual people, and the teaching that Kamika Royal has done does the same kind of thing. But so the Maryland overall rank, mm-hmm. to localize it just for a second, is 16th. We were 15th in economic well-being. We were 12th in education. We were 20th in family and community rank, and a very unhealthy 30th in the ranking around health. Mm-hmm. So what does that tell you about our own state? And I know obviously you were looking at the whole country, but what does it tell you about where we are at this particular juncture?
Right. So you start with what are the resources that a state has. And by most measures, Maryland is the wealthiest state in the country. So from that vantage point, since wealth often predicts child outcomes, poverty predicts poor outcomes, high income predicts better outcomes, you would think that Maryland would be doing better. And again, exactly as you say, these are fairly gross and broad measures. These are not the kind of detailed deep dive that, again, Becky's outfit does to look much more carefully at the statistics that are only available in Maryland. We can only use those statistics that are available for all the states, but every state has other statistics that help really tell the story behind the story. And Kamika's work, really, I think, to lift up. So what's the experience of children? Not just the numbers, but mm-hmm. what's the stories of the children and their families that really explain the day-to-day experience that mm-hmm. we ought to be attending to?
And Kamika Royal, as you read this report, what jumps out at you?
Oh, so many things. I have to say that my own research focuses on school reform, but also urban educators in particular. So I was definitely drawn to the data about how students are performing in school, but especially the data that's disaggregated by race. So for me, being 12th sounds nice, but it actually doesn't tell us enough of the story. Because if we disaggregate it by race and then looked at counties, right, and cities, my question is, where would Maryland fall then? And where would the municipalities within Maryland fall then? When I look at things like, fourth grade, 80-something percent of African-American fourth graders, according to this report, aren't reading on grade level, the thing that I'm like, but they don't teach themselves to read, right? Like this, we share this data. I know it's a marker, right? It tells us something. But what we also know is that 9-year-olds aren't sort of responsible for their own reading. They're not going to school and setting books on fire and saying, no, I don't want to learn to read. So there's more going on there that this report almost sort of alludes to, but doesn't really get to.
And Becky Wagner, there's a young guy, a young African-American writer. His name is Kondwani Fidel, and he published a piece in The Medium a few weeks ago. I think it was reprinted in last week's City paper, if I'm not mistaken. He's getting his MFA at the University of Baltimore as a writer. He reminds me very much of Dee Watkins. I wouldn't Yes. be surprised if they know each other pretty well. And he makes the point, he coins a term called zip code genocide, which is to say where you happen to be born is going to indicate, as Patrick was saying, you know, in terms of wealth and stuff, it's going to indicate what might happen to you. He makes a point that kids in his neighborhood on the east side refer to our city as Bodymore Murderland, where mm-hmm. others, myself included, call it Charm City. Mm-hmm. So the racial perspective here is hugely important, it seems to me. And as I look at these numbers, that's one of the things that really pops out at me. Is that something you're finding
in your
work?
It's absolutely true. At ACY, we lead with the data. We're bipartisan.
And that's Advocates for Children and Youth.
Yes. and it's bipartisan. So what we look at are numbers that have been sorted out, and we know very well. If we look at disaggregated data, we could tell you in a minute what zip code those children are likely from, both in the city and both in the surrounds of the city and on the Eastern Shore and in Western Maryland. But you won't be surprised that the city and several rural counties have high concentrations of poverty. And those high concentrations of poverty are what have an adverse impact for teachers, for families. There's no way out. The community doesn't have the capacity to support each other in the way that it used to. And I would just throw in that pot of things that we can't discount the mass incarceration that occurs in certain neighborhoods and the impact that removing African-American men from their communities has in the long term.
Mm-hmm. And Patrick, let's talk a little bit about the trends. Some of the trends are promising. I mean, the difference between this report and a year before is maybe a percentage or two, but still it's trending in the right direction. Talk about some of the things that you found that were positive in terms of how it compares to previous years.
Sure. So one of the things we did in this report was to compare data from 2015 with data from 2010. And just to remind everybody, of course, that was in 2010, we were just coming out of the recession. So the improvements that we see are in things like the likelihood that a child will live in a family where the parent has full-time employment. The child poverty rate has ticked down just a bit. It was at 22%, it's down to 21%. And of course, that's better than going up, but still, more than one out of five kids in America are growing up in a family that's in poverty, despite our national resources. You mentioned health insurance. We have seen a 38% improvement in the numbers of kids who have health insurance. Matter of fact, since 2008 to the present, the number of kids who are uninsured dropped by 50%. That's a great example of why policy matters, and that the well-being of our kids, as I think Kamika was referring to, it's not random. It's not something in the air. It's about choices that we make.
And would you credit the ACA for that improvement?
It's a combination of the Affordable Care Act and the Child Health Improvement Program. So CHIP
program. Uh-huh.
The CHIP program was passed and then expanded as part of the Recovery Act, and then the ACA came in. And it's those two things together. It's a three-legged stool. It's CHIP, it's ACA, and it's the expansion of Medicaid, part of which is ACA and part of which is other programs. But those three legs of the stool are why we've finally gotten the child health insurance down to 5%, still too high. But
that means that 5% are still
uninsured. Why we're at 95% of children being insured. CHIP is up for reauthorization by the end of the month. Everybody knows the ongoing debate about the Affordable Care Act, and much to the surprise of a lot of serious policy analysts, Medicaid is even under attack. So these are choices. Do we want our kids to be healthy or not?
Got plenty to talk about. We're going to continue this conversation when we come back. Dr. Kamika Royal is here. She's an assistant professor of urban education at Loyola University, Maryland, and the co-director of Loyola's Center for Innovation in Urban Education. Becky Wagner is the executive director of Advocates for Children and Youth here in Baltimore. And Patrick McCarthy, he's the president and CEO of the Annie E. Casey Foundation. We're talking about a report that the Casey Foundation released recently called the Kids Count Data Book. It's a state-by-state analysis of child well-being. We'd love to hear from you and have you join our conversation. Our phone number 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wipr.org. To join us on Twitter, you can find us at Midday Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back, everybody. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, it's Midday at the Movies. We'll have Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival and Max Weiss of Baltimore Magazine here. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will join us with a preview of the 2017-18 theater season here in Baltimore and its environs. And by the way, coming up Friday, my guest here in Studio A will be Senator Ben Cardin. He's the ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about the best places to be a child in a report that gives state-by-state kids count rankings of child well-being released recently by the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Becky Wagner is the executive director of Advocates for Children and Youth. They're based here in Baltimore. Patrick McCarthy is the president and CEO of the Annie E. Casey Foundation. They're also based here in Baltimore. And Dr. Kamika Royal, she teaches urban education at Loyola University, Maryland, and she co-directs Loyola's Center for Innovation in Urban Education. You are welcome to be part of our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Kamika Royal, you turned me on to an article in Atlantic Magazine by a woman named Melinda Anderson, and there's a peer-reviewed journal called Child Development that talks about the very notion of the so-called American dream. And of course, our dreamers have been very much front of mind in the last 48 hours, given President Trump's decision to rescind the DACA executive order that President Obama signed a couple years ago. And she talks about, in this piece in The Atlantic, that the American ideal that hard work and perseverance will naturally always lead to success. That's an interesting narrative, and it's just not true for a lot of kids, isn't it?
It's not true for a lot of people, period. And so it's an article I'll be using with my Intro to Education and Foundations of Education class this year. But I always talk to them about how some we believe in this sort of false notion of social mobility, right? It assumes that all things are equal. It assumes that we don't have the racist history in this country that we do. It assumes that all opportunity and access to opportunity is equal, and that people's work will be interpreted in the same ways. And those things aren't true. And we put a lot of pressure on children and families to succeed regardless of the barriers that exist, instead of, as professionals and adults, addressing those barriers. We put the responsibility on young people and their families. And when you're up against those barriers, right, we then tell them that it's their fault if they don't succeed against those barriers, because if they ran faster, you know, worked harder, got better grades, that things would be different, when we know sometimes that that's actually not the case.
But Becky Wagner, if they're not going to run faster, they're not going to work harder, and they're not going to get better grades, are they going to succeed? I mean, when we define the metrics for this, it's difficult to do this in a way that is, you know, quote unquote, fair to everybody, I guess.
Sure. Well, we have to look. That's why we look at systems. That's why, as Patrick said, policies matter. So when you think of the trauma that children are walking through the school door with, and you think of the teacher who has 30 kids with 85% of them struggling with five or six or seven other issues, hunger, are the lights on, mom or dad at the house, any after school care, was it safe to get to school today? So the teacher then is supposed to make everybody successful and happy. So we have two sides of this. What I would suggest is that, you know, what's fair is not always what's equal. And we have to look at places, for example, that have high concentrations of poverty. The State General Assembly has to decide the Kerwin Commission formulas this coming year. We advocates are urging that the concentrated poverty factor be considered to increase funding for those schools that are impacted by that, to create wraparound services, to create after-school opportunities. I mean, if I get to play the flute and you're not even allowed to get to a music class because it's not in your family's budget, you know, I'm never going to be a good flute player, but I've had the opportunity, I've had the exposure. And so we have to consider that socioeconomic piece cannot be discounted.
And Patrick McCarthy, you talk about the need to prioritize poverty reduction, because it is a holistic thing. I mean, if a kid is food insecure, housing insecure, if mom or dad don't have access to a good grocery store or good health care, it's just going to be very difficult, as, you know, Kamika Royal mentions, for any 9-year-old to get through. So what are the ways then that public policy should be directed in terms of poverty reduction that's going to lead to better outcomes in these other areas?
Well, that's actually the good news. Although there are no silver bullets, we actually know quite a bit about what's necessary to lift kids out of poverty. We know that when a family is more economically secure, children do better. They're more likely to do better in school. They're more likely to graduate. They're more likely to get a job themselves as they grow up. So things like the earned income tax credit that incentivizes and rewards work, but also provides needed economic support for a family, can improve child well-being. Same with the child tax credit. Again, a work-based, child-focused federal policy that provides additional resources to families. Things like the health insurance programs we were talking about actually makes it less likely that families will fall into poverty due to medical bankruptcy, which is a huge driver of economic inequality in the country. At the same time, we know that high-quality early childhood education works. Now, more than half of the kids in America, 3- and 4-year-olds, don't have any exposure to high quality or any early childhood education. They come to school never having received the kind of supports that you get.
Programs like Head Start, Early Head Start,
other daycare programs that are focused on early childhood education. So we know that simultaneously focusing on the parents' economic well-being, jobs, incentives, wealth creation, all of those things are necessary, and simultaneously focusing on child development, early childhood education, grade level reading, proficiency at math. Those, we have to work on those simultaneously to lift folks out of poverty. But we've been able to demonstrate that, in fact, you can reduce poverty with those kinds of policy choices. It's not the only thing, but it's a critical piece of the puzzle.
It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Patrick McCarthy is with the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Dr. Kamika Royal is at Loyola University of Maryland, and Becky Wagner heads up Advocates for Children and Youth. Let's run to the phones. Mike in Baltimore, welcome to the program. Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Yes, I'd just like to put in a plug for Baltimoreans to work and volunteer and be involved with the other zip codes. We live more in the central part of the city, but we've my wife and I have been involved in like Roots and Branches Charter School, trying to provide this quality education for children with the founder parents, and still involved in the gardens and working as volunteers at the school. And, you know, I have an 8-year-old. He happens to go to school at St. Pius in the county, but I know, and if I can be permitted with a spiritual comment, I know God loves my child. I love my child. But God loves all children equally. So I just think we have to keep all the kids in mind and do our part to help other people and children that we might not think of or see every day. And so just plea to Baltimore.
Thanks for your call, Mike. I appreciate it. By the way, our phone number here on Midday, if you'd like to join our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Kamika Royal, you've written about this term that has just become part of the common parlance, the achievement gap. Mm-hmm. When we talk about poverty, we talk about, as Patrick mentioned, you know, more than half of the little kids are not getting into early Head Start programs. I was shocked by one of the statistics here. The young children not in school, this is nationally, 53% of kids. That's a percent higher than it was between 2009 and 2011. So way more than half of the kids aren't even in the school. Mm-hmm. When we talk about this achievement gap, there's a problem with that parlance, isn't there, in your perspective?
There's a problem with the parlance and also with the ideology. So we live and we sit in a country where it was law and policy that to teach enslaved Black people, I won't say African Americans, right, because we weren't Americans, right, but for literacy was illegal. There are historians who've documented the ways in which post-slavery, in the state of Alabama, for example, Black schools, because segregation was mandated by law, weren't permitted to have school as many hours as white schools were, right? So you have history and generations of families with their literacy not being where it needs to be. And then we look at people and say, well, how come these students, you know, aren't reading well? Well, there's a number of reasons for that. One, by law, at some point, on an ongoing basis, education was forbidden to some extent. And now we have people who sort of willfully, we have some, you know, it's always a little hard when you talk about this, but we have schools and school systems where they are willfully undereducating our children. And here's what I mean.
Willfully undereducating.
Willfully undereducating. When I heard my fellow panelists here a few minutes ago talk about the difference between fair and equal, right? That's something I often teach my classes. Fair and equal is not the same thing.
Yeah, equality and equity.
Two very different things. And I could give everybody in the room a pair of size 10 black pumps, and that's equal, but that's not fair. Right. Everybody can't wear pumps. Everybody doesn't wear a size 10. It might not match your outfit.
And for the record, I look terrific. just want to make sure that we're clear on that.
Thank you. But, you know, when I think about Baltimore City schools, for example, and this narrative that, you know, oh, Baltimore City, there's already more spent on Baltimore City school students than anywhere else in the state. But it's still not enough based on the needs that our children and families are bringing to school. Right. So when you when you aren't providing them with the resources they need, not based on what everybody else is getting, but based on what they need, based on the area in which they live, based on the poverty they face, based on whether or not their parents have stable employment, based on exposure to lead, right? All types of other things. And then we go, well, why aren't you doing well? That's what I mean by willfully undereducating, because it's not just on our educators who are overly taxed, but we're not providing them with the resources in order to meet the needs of the students who have the greatest needs. That's why when I hear people talk, anytime somebody starts a conversation with me about achievement gap, I'm like, this is not a conversation that we're going to have, because we continue to watch people perpetuate, say, well, why does this gap exist? Well, where are the resources? At what point, one of my mentors, Dr. Gloria Ladson Billings, has written about the education debt, right? That there's those of us, our ancestors who built this country for nothing, who built this country in exchange for whips and chains and being dispossessed of our lands, we're owed a debt by this country. And so instead of talking about the achievement gap and placing on the backs of our children who may not be achieving what they should be, asking, well, what are we doing to pay back to them what their ancestors gave to this country? Right. And that's a conversation that I think we need to have. Should we look at how students are performing? Absolutely. But they aren't teaching themselves. They aren't going into classes, you know, young people, third graders, and saying, I don't want to learn math today. I'm not really interested in that.
Yeah. And Becky Wagner, there's not only a racial disparity dimension to this, but there's a gender disparity. Just a couple of years ago, this is a piece in The Washington Post by a woman named Emily Badger, published just like a week and a half after the uprising, the unrest, the riot, whatever you want to call it, in April of 2015, that being a black boy, the worst place to grow up as a black boy in the United States, the worst place is the city of Baltimore. That the this is research done by a couple guys at Harvard University, that the earnings deficit, the way they paired this particular metric, that every year that a poor boy spends growing up in Baltimore, his earnings as an adult fall by 1.5%. So it means that by the time he's 26 years old, he earns about 28% less than he would have if he'd grown up someplace else. Mm-hmm. So you deal with kids in Baltimore all the time. What do we do about that?
Well, I think I already mentioned the mass incarceration piece. I think kids need to grow up with role models that are women and men. And I think that Baltimore's boys don't have very many role models. That may be a presumption that's not backed by data, although that may be backed by data. So the city has and the state has poured a ton of money. You remember after the uprising, there were just article after article about how much money had been poured into communities without any evidence of success. We could reverse that and say, who was deciding what the community needed? Did the community have a voice in what they needed? And did the city and state double down on what was really needed? You know, most political decisions are made not on merit. And that could be the case here.
And a whole lot of them don't seem to be made on data either, Patrick. I mean, there is an emotional thing. I mean, when I look at something like mandatory sentencing, which the Baltimore City Council, the mayor, the president of the city council, the police chief all jumped on and said, oh, we got to do this, which is kind of ironic. We have three African-American leaders in our city getting on the bandwagon of something that research has shown pretty definitively doesn't work. Doesn't make the streets safer. It just makes more people being in jail. I mean, there is, and in the Trump administration, there seems to be an anti-science, anti-data bias. I mean, when we look at things like climate change and whatnot. I mean, as you look at the landscape of data, like the kind of stuff that you're collecting here, and it's the receptivity of that data by people who hold political power. What do you see?
Well, it's a fascinating mix. On the one hand, there's a segment of the political sector that is more open to evidence and data-based decision-making and science than we've ever had before. But at least right now, it feels like it's being overwhelmed by the political benefit of basically appealing to people's raw emotion and stereotype, and the kind of, the technical term is implicit bias, but it's basically deeply ingrained personal racism that we are reinforced about day after day after day, that informs not only our interpersonal reactions with people, but sadly begins to inform our policy. There's a reason why we have mass incarceration that goes directly to days of slavery and then Jim Crow and then mass incarceration. It's a very, very clear line that you can draw. So it's not, again, randomness. There are choices that have been made, and sadly, it pays political benefit.
410-662-8780 is our number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go to the phones again. James in Park Heights, welcome to the show. Thanks for the call.
Good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon.
And your panel. How you doing? I'm an education advocate, and I speak regularly at Baltimore City School System board meetings. And the Park test scores that just came out recently, it was conveyed on Fox 45 Project Baltimore, talks about the math scores for Baltimore City students who were tested were, there was only 15% proficient. That means 85% were not proficient in reading, and 12% in math. That means 88% were not proficient in math. That's almost 90% in math. We have a society that's largely guided now employment-wise on science, technology, engineering, and math. And when children in the schools can't pass, and they know that they're not getting an adequate education, that's why a lot of them give up and seek camaraderie out here in the streets, because I've mentored young men over the years. And that data in itself should be mind-boggling to anybody that gets it, because they've had the opportunity to make adjustments so that they could try to get our kids where they need to be over the last 4 years, and that hasn't happened. So America believes that education is the key to success to a large degree, but the whole child is more important in Baltimore City, as I've experienced it, and most advocates have experienced it, because most children in Baltimore City public schools don't get an adequate education because of the ratio of pupil-teachers. The teacher-pupil ratio in Baltimore City schools is extremely high, and with no assistance in most of the classes, it's abysmal that you expect positive results from this. But as an advocate, I have to continue to press the school board and the CEO that they're going to have to put more resources into math in particular. But this new blueprint that they have out, which is going to utilize more art and physical education, things like that. That's something that we knew worked a long time ago, and the school system mm-hmm. took it away. Now they're going back to it.
Well, James,
in the meantime, kids are falling by the wayside.
James, I appreciate your advocacy. I appreciate the call. Before we take a break, Dr. Royal, James's points about math in this Casey Foundation Kids Count report. The eighth graders who are not proficient in math, this is nationally, this is not Baltimore, 88% of African-American eighth graders are not, 81% of Native Americans and 81% Hispanic kids not proficient in math at the eighth grade. How do you teach that better? How do we change the way we're teaching or what we're teaching or what needs to change to get those numbers down?
It starts much earlier than the eighth grade, right? So I was telling the panelists, this is my second time living in Baltimore. I lived here 18 years ago. I moved here to be a middle school teacher. And I was teaching seventh grade.
In the city.
My school is closed now. I taught at Robert Poole Middle School. I taught seventh grade language arts. Many of my middle schoolers struggled with multiplication, right? So it's hard to start teaching algebra at the middle school level when you're struggling with multiplication. Division is hard if you're struggling with multiplication. And what we found was that a number of our students, even as I was a literacy coach in D.C., in high school, a number of our students had some number sense issues, right? So this idea of like what numbers mean and ratios and proportions and how to interpret those numbers, those are things that children should learn very, very early. But when they aren't learning those things because they're dealing with a host of other issues and teachers say, well, I can't get to everything, right? So what am I going to focus on math? Am I going to focus on literacy? I'm trying to get the students to sit down. Those things go by the wayside. That's how you end up with eighth graders who are underperforming. But it's not because
is it possible then to do some remediation at the eighth grade to get them up to speed?
It's possible, but you're also dealing with some very angry 13-year-olds at that point who aren't stupid and know I shouldn't have to be working on this at this point. Somewhere I didn't learn this, and there are other students who have learned this, and now I, in my mind, something is wrong with me because I can't remember how to multiply in order.
So the whole notion of self-esteem and everything runs. Okay, plenty to talk about. We got a bunch of calls we're going to try to get to when we come back from a break. That's Dr. Kamika Royal. She's a scholar of urban education at Loyola University, Maryland, and the co-director of Loyola's Center for Innovation in Urban Education. Becky Wagner is the executive director of Advocates for Children and Youth, and they are a partner with the Casey Foundation Kids Count Project. Patrick McCarthy is the president and CEO of the Annie E. Casey Foundation. When we come back, we'll take as many of your calls and emails as we can get to. 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR, where you're listening to Midday.
Welcome back, everybody. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, with school starting for children here in Maryland and across the country, we thought it'd be a good time to take a look at some data surrounding the well-being of America kids. We're talking about the Kids Count Project. That's an initiative of the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Dr. Patrick McCarthy is the president and CEO of the Casey Foundation. Dr. Kamika Royal is an assistant professor of urban education at Loyola University, Maryland, and she co-directs Loyola's Center for Innovation in Urban Education. And Becky Wagner is the executive director of Advocates for Children and Youth. They're based here in Baltimore. Our phone number, 410-662-87 80, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. Let's try to sneak in a couple of phone calls. Josh in Baltimore, welcome to Midday.
Hey, I just wanted to add a comment about housing policy in Baltimore City and sort of the history. A good book on this subject is Not My Neighborhood, but sort of how we have this term called the black butterfly and the white L, and how education policy is totally tied to the resources of each community. And, you on top of that, you add what you were discussing about mass incarceration. The drug war has sort of been focused more in the black butterfly, which has caused this decrease in social capital in these neighborhoods. And, it's caused so many issues. Education, just one article I saw the other day is Johns Hopkins is giving out free eyeglasses, and it's caused test scores to go up. just wanted to add that to the discussion.
Well, thanks for the call, Josh. And Lena Nguyen, the Baltimore City Health Commissioner, has also had a program that they got with private philanthropic money, Patrick McCarthy, to buy and distribute glasses. One of the findings of the report, this Kids Count data book, Patrick, more families living in high poverty neighborhoods now than before. So when there is when there are these concentrations of poverty and there's more people living within these areas of high poverty, because as Becky says, I mean, when we talk about the murder rate here in Baltimore, the murder rate is fine in Roland Park and Homeland and Guilford and Ashburton. You know, it's perfectly fine. It's horrible in the same four zip codes it was horrible in 1968, you know, so these concentrations are really difficult. What's the public policy dimension of that in terms of dispersing and attenuating these high poverty districts?
Yeah, let's start with just reminding ourselves that these high poverty areas were created intentionally, and they go back to the first law passed in the U.S. to mandate segregation. Housing segregation was passed in Baltimore. And if you look at the, that was ruled unconstitutional, but if you look at the use of redlining, restrictive covenants, et cetera, and you track where African Americans were allowed to live, and then you overlay on that where poverty is, you see a very consistent kind of story. So again, policy is about choice. We made a series of choices that disadvantaged whole populations of folks. We can make choices that won't disadvantage them. For example, we know that, again, let's look beyond the city to include the entire region. There are still parts of our region that make it very difficult through zoning laws for folks with low income to live in communities outside the city. We know that, and again, this is complicated and controversial, but we know that federal resources too often go only to focusing on building up the housing stock in already poor areas, rather than looking at opportunities to give people a path to different communities in which they can live. And let's be clear, those of us who are white and have been advantaged for our entire lives, we own this problem. This is not a black problem. This is a white problem. So to the extent that we continue to collaborate with you, cooperate to encourage racial segregation by community, we will have racially segregated communities.
Becky Wagner, we mentioned that Maryland ranks 30th overall in the country by the metrics of the Casey Foundation Kids Count data book. It's interesting that the top five states are New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Vermont, Minnesota, and Iowa. So what that says to me is, with the exception of Massachusetts, there's a whole lot of white people living in the top four out of five states in the United States in terms by these metrics. What does that say to you, and what does that mean for what we can do here in Baltimore?
Oh, that's a big question. You know, I think when we're looking for progressive policies, there are some states we always look to, frankly. Massachusetts, New Hampshire. I'm a little surprised at the Iowa, though. But there has to be community will. People have to want to improve these specific things. Sometimes I think it's tied to scarcity. You know, if you have that much, how can you have that much and I have none? And if I share what I have, then will I have enough? And I don't know that we white people can reconcile that. The Maryland General Assembly is historically democratic. We historically tie Democrats to progressive policy, except in the South. Maryland is very much a Southern state in terms of our history. And I think we need to ask ourselves who we really are. I mean, I think it comes back to community will. And then we have to get into a nonpartisan discussion, which I shouldn't do.
Mm-hmm. And Kamika Royal, what about community will? Where does that say? Is this a problem premised in the unwillingness of the political ruling class to address these problems in any serious way? I mean, is will something that you see as a as a really important factor in all of this?
I think will is a huge factor. As I was listening to you talk, I'm thinking about when I drive down Lake Avenue coming from Towson and how the houses there for sale say Baltimore County Schools, right? So, and they're selling
because it's close to the border of Baltimore City.
Mm-hmm. And so they want to be very clear with people that your children won't have to go to Baltimore City Schools. Baltimore County residents therefore benefit from the low idea that people have of Baltimore City Schools, and they get to say, well, my child goes to, you know, a county school, right? I definitely think it's a will issue. And I'm thinking about zero-sum politics, right? That kind of sums up what you were saying. And I think when I'm listening to you, it sounds like something that, you know, I probably shouldn't say the word socialism, but I think that we need to have a different will that says that we aren't looking at people saying, I need to hoard all the resources, or assuming that something is wrong with them because they don't have resources. And I just don't know that there is the will to do that.
Let's go to the phones. Sharon in Owings Mills, as I understand it, you are a parent of Baltimore County School kids, or perhaps you yourself graduated from Baltimore County Schools. Welcome to the show.
No, I didn't graduate from Baltimore County. I'm initially from New York area, but my kids did go to Baltimore County Schools. My son did just recently graduate from a magnet program in Lansdowne. And one of the things that I think needs to be brought into everybody's attention is school environment. Lansdowne has wonderful teachers. Patapsco has wonderful teachers. Lansdowne and Patapsco both have magnet programs, yet those buildings are falling apart. How would you feel if you went to a school and you were trying to learn in a building that's falling apart? That says something to you about how your government feels. And I can definitely say that it is a government thing, the lack of willingness to give funding to the poor areas of the county and hoard it all into the areas like Towson and Perry Hall, and even some of the places in Owings Mills where I'm from, I think is wrong. I think it should be equal all over the county and not taken away from the people in Lansdowne and Patapsco and Dundalk, because these kids have just as much right to learn as anybody else. It's not just poor black kids, it's poor white kids in that area. It's Latino, it's military, it's, you know, whatever you want.
Well, Sharon, thank you for the call. Patrick, we just have a little bit of time left, there are 45 seconds or so. One of the recommendations you make in the report is a bigger investment in early childhood education. But what do you do to the eighth grader who is not proficient in math at that moment on that, you know, November Tuesday where you are teaching that child how to add and subtract?
You know, the good news is that the human brain is incredibly resilient, and the human spirit is incredibly resilient. And certainly it's tougher to get somebody back on track and to provide them with skills that they should have acquired years before. But there are so many examples where that's possible to do, not just individual by individual, but group by group. It takes will. It takes the entire community rallying together and saying, if we have to provide additional tutoring, we have to provide additional supports, we have to deal with trauma, et cetera, then that's something we have to do.
And we just can't give up. Well, I appreciate all of you being here this afternoon and for the work that all of you are doing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Becky Wagner is the Executive Director of Advocates for Children and Youth. Patrick McCarthy is the President and CEO of the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Dr. Kamika Royal is Assistant Professor of Urban Education at Loyola University, Maryland, and Co-Director of Loyola's Center for Innovation in Urban Education. We've got a link to the Casey Foundation's Kids Count data book information on our website, wypr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's Midday at the Movies with Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival and Max Weiss, the managing editor and film critic for Baltimore Magazine. Plus, theater critic Jaywin Russick has a preview of what's cooking on the live theater scene in and around Baltimore this season. And by the way, on Friday, Senator Ben Cardin will be my guest here in Studio A. He's the ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. We'll talk about North Korea, the DACA decision, the debt ceiling, tax reform, and other issues that are on the very full legislative plate that faces Congress these days. That's coming up Friday. Hope you can join us. Lunch for our guest today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. Coming up, the premiere of a new show here on WYPR, Life in the Balance. Today, host Aaron Henkin explores the challenges of re-entry in society and the job market after incarceration. That's coming up right after a break for the news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your listening. Have a great day.